I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Unsung heroes. Unsung heroes.
Hi, you're listening to Ricky Wilde and this is Unsung Heroes. Thank you for joining us again. This week we have an absolute legend of the 80s and a legend of these days of the 2020s. Mr. Nick Kershaw. I mean, what a talent this guy is. An incredible songwriter, incredible producer, beautiful lyricist. I'm a real fan of Nick and I feel so lucky to be able to actually call him a good mate as well. We've done many gigs together and tours. Yeah, well, I love the guy. What can I say? I gave him a bell to see if he'd be up for doing Unsung Heroes with us. And within a second, he said, yeah, count me in. And here he is in my studio and we're all having a chat. So there's Nick, there's me and there's Lee. And there's also another chap. He's a new artist. He goes under the moniker of Le Avenue. His name is Jesse Reuben Wilson. And Jesse very kindly agreed to come up. But the lovely thing is that Jesse's a massive fan of Nick's as well. So it was lovely because Lee and I decided that it'd be a really nice idea to put it in record when they actually meet for the first time. So the beginning of the pod is actually Jesse walking in and meeting Nick. And it goes from there. And we had such a beautiful chat. It was such a long chat that I thought it was too long for one podcast. So what I've decided to do is actually split it into two because I couldn't edit any of it out because it was just all so bloody interesting and lovely to be involved in. So Nick's one I'm gonna put over two pods. And this is part one. So let's just get straight into it. Ladies and gentlemen, Nick Kershaw and Jesse from L'Avenue.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Great.
So good to meet you, mate.
You too.
How are you, mate?
Very
you
well.
Right?
Very well.
Thank you.
Good. Nice to see you.
Thank you for coming out.
Oh, absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So oh, mate.
It's an honour right. That you are.
Right, you're going to
so,
get in there.
Oh, not at all. Pleasure. Not at all. Come in.
And squeeze in over there.
Monsieur.
Hello, man.
It's an absolute honour to meet you.
An honour. Hear that, Ricky? It's an honour, mate.
Is that what Ricky says?
That's what he says to me every time he meets me. Once again, it's an honour.
So sit down, Jess. Come and join us, man.
Shall I derobe?
Yeah, no, yeah. Get yourself comfortable, mate.
It won't work on radio or podcast, but what a jacket.
Oh, that's a very cool jacket.
I'm sorry I haven't got one for you. It's all production.
Okay, yeah.
I needed a double check.
I'm sure you wouldn't have one big enough, I don't think. Yeah, how lovely to have you.
To be here.
Yeah,
seriously, it's so great to meet you.
Oh, bless
you. You know,
bless
really you. It is. And well, thanks for being such a supporter, such a proponent in the early days of this blossoming new project.
Well, Lee sent me some tracks, and he's always sending me tracks, but the one particular track I really liked was Lipstick
and Sushi. Yes.
And I just fell in love with that track.
Thanks.
And as it happens, I was just going on holiday to Portofino,
which I
don't normally talk about that, but we can talk about that a little bit more if you want. So we're in Portofino listening to that full blast in my headphones, and it was absolutely beautiful. And
We are in record.
I'm hoping we are.
It'll be on the internet forever.
And I just fell in love with it. And I downloaded the album and just absolutely loved it. And yeah, congratulations on a fantastic album.
Oh, thank you, Ricky. That's really something else. You must be so chuffed with it. Well, when people such as yourself say things like that, it makes all the hard work, you know, very, very worth it. So thank you very much.
For me, it was lovely to hear all those beautiful old synth sounds. I did tweet that to you.
Yeah, you did. I was very impressed with your knowledge on that.
I remember having my D50, and I had the rack-mounted version, the D550 as well.
Yeah.
And for the touring. And I remember all those beautiful sounds, and with the advent of all the soft synths coming through, I thought, why do I need all these synths anymore? And I thought I was being so clever by selling it all. And now I look back now, what the fuck was I thinking? I must have been mental.
Many skips have been recipients of my... Oberheims have gone in there. PPGs have gone in there. They just kind of, nobody's going to listen to them anymore.
It's like lacerations when you said that.
I'm sorry about that. So are you using the real thing or are you using them?
Well, funnily enough, I still do have a Roland Juno 60.
You're joking.
No, I really have. But sadly, the pots have got a bit dirty, you know, on the volume.
That was when I first got my deal with MCA Records and I got me £5.50 advance. I went out and I thought I'm going to buy some gear, and the keyboard I bought was a Juno 60.
Brilliant. Yeah, because you toured with that, right? I remember.
We saw that. And a lot of the sounds on that first album were that.
Yeah. I can't get rid of it. And I've jokingly said, you know, when they put me, you know, 6 feet under, there'll be me, there'll be the Juno 60, then the missus.
In that order?
God, that's on tape.
I'll edit it, don't worry.
I also did buy a JX8P.
Oh, yeah.
Purely because in the very early days, I'd gone to a studio, and I remember when they came out. And, you know, with Juno 60, there's all the knobs and the faders, but when the JX8P came out, there was nothing. Yeah. I mean, it's literally just flat, and it was just something else. And I managed to pick one up for about £300 off this guy in Margate, where I'd, funnily enough, that's where the studio was that I'd originally got one. But those are the only two bits of... And I've got a Rhodes Mark II.
Yeah,
which is just beautiful. I'll never get rid of that either. But the rest is, you know, I mean, it's a joke. I was thinking about this. I was reading up on, you know, some of your work with use of Fairlight. You know, what were they, 25K?
Probably.
I had the Synclavier as well. Quid. I've got the keyboard, the old keyboard of the Synclavier. But the brain obviously is absolutely fucked, so I chucked that out.
Right.
So, but I kept the keyboard just for sentimental
prosperity.
Yeah, for sentimental reasons.
There was a whole room at Psalm West that about twice the size of this room, which is just full of Trevor Horn's Synclavier gathering moss.
That was so expensive in those days.
Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds.
That's why I bought the little one, and the little one was like £30,000, I think it was.
Wow.
And then obviously the Fairlights as well. As you said, they're about £25,000, I think they were a pop. But amazing to think what £25,000 buys these days.
That was just a little green screen monitor and a keyboard.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it. That's what you got for £25,000.
You're paying for the R&D, basically. Yeah. But they were amazing synths. And when you listen to, like, Beat It, you know, that that sound, that was all Synclavier. And they were distinctive sounds. But it's so lovely hearing your stuff, Jess, when you're hearing all those beautiful original sounds.
Yeah.
And the moment I heard all that just brought it all back to me.
Brilliant.
And it's a really, really... really nice vibe.
It was a very quick reaction with Ricky, because sometimes I send him stuff and I'll prompt him and say, I sent you that, what was that like? And I can tell he's either not listened to it or he's gone in and gone, pshw. But this was instant. This was, oh my God, I love this EP, what is this? Mm. What have you sent me? And it was on repeat, because you were like, I've had this on over and over and over and over again. So I knew you'd hit the spot really quickly.
But also when you're on holiday as well, it's perfect.
Just listening.
It's not working quite so well in the car park in Hartford. It doesn't have quite the same effect.
Oh, it does.
Oh, okay, it does.
That's if you're bored.
It takes you there. It takes you back to Portofino. Okay, fine. Yeah.
What does it sound like in the Bentley?
Oh, you had to bring
just indulge myself. Quickly tell you, I went to see Gary Newman last night.
Wow.
Did you?
Yeah. Wow.
At the Cambridge Corn Exchange.
Wow.
I know about that? That's just...
Cambridge Corn Exchange. Wow.
It was fucking amazing.
Wow.
And what I loved about it was that historically he has done gigs where he hasn't played Cars. And I thought, how can you not play Cars?
Well, he didn't play any of the old tunes.
At certain points. But last night he played Cars. Down in the Park sounded so good. It was like really, really tough, you know. There were lots of guitars and it was so beautiful. And obviously our friends Electric sounded incredible. And May I Disconnect, which was one of my all-time favourites of his as well. In fact, there's a sound in May I Disconnect that I directly lifted off for Kids in America, like a white noise phasing sound that I added over the top. And there's so many influences from Gary Newman, from my stuff.
Right.
So it's it was so beautiful just to see him still there and doing it and rocking out. And he was amazing.
I saw Gary, funnily enough, at the Margate Winter Gardens, and it must have been 83?
Yeah.
83. And it was back in the days where he had that whole sort of stage set with all the neon bars and it. I mean, just visually, it was such a spectacle.
Oh, it was so good. It was so good. Yeah, really enjoyed it. Yeah. So anyway, just thought I wanted to
tell
you all about that.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing.
Nicky Boy, thank you for coming.
That's a pleasure.
Always lovely to see you. We've been on tour many times and loads of gigs and had lots of fun.
Yeah. In fact, I was thinking in 34 years, I don't ever remember having a sensible conversation with you.
So this is going to be a test.
Yeah, this is going to be quite a test.
We're normally drunk, aren't we? We're normally sort of
drunk or hungover. One of the two.
Yeah, vodka and tonic is your one, I think, isn't it?
First time I ever met Rick, right? It was in a hotel somewhere. He says, "What would you like a drink?" I said, "I'll have a vodka and tonic, please." So he turned up at the table with a pint glass.
What?
So there's a tiny little bottle of tonic there and a pint glass full of vodka. That was his, is a vodka and tonic.
Yeah, you've got a taste of vodka.
You can't drown it. Exactly, yeah.
So we got a little bit.
This is the start of a beautiful friendship.
So, what are you up to at the moment, Nick?
I'm in between jobs. No, I'm obviously the usual festivals and malarkey, and it's still kind of almost. I've got a few more gigs this year, a couple of little trips to Denmark and Finland, and some of the Let's Rock Arena shows. For Christmas, but other than that, I'm kind of trying to finish off an album, one of them album things.
Wow, people still do that.
They still do that, and that's about the last one was 2012, so it's well overdue.
Beautiful album that was.
Thank you very much.
Mm. So obviously, there's a bit of a mutual admiration thing. I know Nick's been listening to your stuff as well, Jess, and. So
lovely.
Yeah.
He's just exploded in the studio, just to be clear.
So what have you been up to, Jess?
Oh God! I mean,
loads.
I have done. I have been a busy boy.
Yeah.
I must admit, it's somewhat surreal being here. I'm just trying to stay calm and collected, and
I think it's lovely to have you here, Jess. It really is. I'm a huge fan. We Lee and I, we went to Grace Lightman's gig
the other night,
and I was a fanboy. Literally, I was a proper fanboy.
We were together.
The restraining orders on the way.
At the midnight.
Oh, the midnight. Yes, the midnight gig.
That was bizarre that we were all there. And Nina was there.
Where I met Nina. Yeah. Lee introduced me to Nina.
Yeah,
I forced you on to Nina. Is what happened in terms of, no, I can't talk to her. Yes, you can. Off you go.
Lee has his blog, Teasers and Dares, and
he's been very kind to me on that blog. Actually, on more than one occasion. So Thank you, Lee.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Teasesanddares.com.
And he'd reviewed some of Nina's stuff as well. So obviously seeing Nina there, it was a nice moment for him to say, I'm Lee from Teasers and Dares. And obviously,
and then Rick pushed me out of the way and was like, and I'm Ricky Wilde. Would you like a pint of vodka?
You've done a couple of tracks with her too, right?
So, and through that, she's been up here a couple of times with Laura Fairs, her partner, who's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing writer. And they're both lovely girls.
Yeah.
And so, we've had a couple of days writing, which I absolutely loved. And I'm hoping they're going to come back and do some more work.
Brilliant.
But I noticed yesterday that you tweeted Nina, or liked one of her tweets. And I was thinking, what a great
collaboration waiting to happen.
Yeah, it would be fantastic. I mean, the interesting thing with this project is it's been mostly instrumental, because all my other projects have been vocal orientated projects.
Yeah.
And it was so great to sort of end up doing this new project, because there were no real limits, apart from you sort of had to stay 80s somewhat, but there were no constraints to what you could do. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to go full on instrumental for a while here. And
so it was a deliberate.
It was pretty much deliberate.
The whole 80s thing was a deliberate. Why did you go in that direction? What was your inspiration for that?
Yeah, the short story is that I've been producing numerous different genres that are all sort of loosely connected over the years, and I had another project which is called Ocean Sky, which is actually deep house, believe it or not, but sort of very emotional, you know, melodic, emotive. I'd released some material via a label called Silk Records, which is a sort of Russian US label. And they brought out this remix album by The Midnight, and I was on their mailing list, and this album, you know, got this information, a new release, The Midnight Remixed, and I thought, what's that? Okay, that's interesting.
So good,
check it out.
So good.
Yeah, and I thought the remixes were really good. I was impressed by Tyler's voice and the lyrics and everything
else. Tyler's voice is beautiful.
He's the closest thing to you, funnily enough, I think.
Really?
Really similar,
If that's possible.
So. Is he a little fella?
He's actually not, is he?
No, he's not.
No, he's quite tall.
But just the the tone of his voice, though,
really?
It's interesting. Yeah.
And he can sing all sorts of different stuff, because he does some solo stuff, which is not like The Midnight at all.
Yeah.
Very different. So it's...
So Midnight was an inspiration for you?
Well, what happened was I was interested in the source material. This is an album of remixes. What have they remixed? Discovered Endless Summer. To be honest, this... You know, back in the day, you'd buy an album, standing in the light, level 42 or whatever. I mean, I would play that inside out. I'd copy it to cassette. You know, I wouldn't listen to anything else for probably months. And this was the first time I've done that for, you know, 2 years. No, I'm showing my age now. You know, I just couldn't stop. I went to Prague with the missus, and we stayed there for several days, and we'd hired an Airbnb close to the centre of town. I had it on my phone and a little Bluetooth speaker, and we'd just be playing it in this apartment all the time, and it just kind of soaked up. And what's really bold is the sax. I thought, that is pretty, you're going to go full 80s. And I know Tim,
and there's a lot of it, isn't
there's
there?
A lot of it, but it's brilliantly done.
Absolutely. Do you know what, I remember back in the day, the sax was, it's all over everything. Duran and our stuff,
Spandau,
we used it a fair bit, and every given solo was always a sax, isn't it?
You knew it. And that really took me by surprise, that they were that bold in 2014 or whatever it was, 2015, to go full on. But the player that they've got, and that's what really impressed me, was Tim's production. This was taking this 80s aesthetic, this intangible kind of vibe, and he put contemporary production values on it, you know, so it was full stereo picture, it was top to bottom, and he was using lots of old kit and old sounds, but just doing it in a new way. I just couldn't stop myself. I was like, that's it. And for literally the next kind of 2 months, I got home and spent way too much on, you know, old plugins. And because everything's all the synths we were talking about, they're all in the digital domain. And it was I was like a kid in a candy shop. It's like this and that and everything. And I literally probably spent the next 2 or 3 months, did a whole probably two albums worth of material. And it was one of the best times I've ever had because, like I said, there was no restriction. And
it's become quite a movement, though, hasn't it? It's sort of called synthwave. But
synthwave, yeah.
When we went to see The Midnight, what really struck me is I thought that they were quite a niche kind of, you know, duo that some people knew. They had a bit of an internet following. Right. But the whole of the Scala in London, they sold out two nights.
Yeah.
And everyone there knew the words to every song. It's huge. It was just like, wow, this is much bigger than I thought it was.
But even down to the visuals as well, and the font on the Midnight, and likewise for you and Nina as well.
Yeah,
that there's that font thing with the visual. It's just so powerful and it's
very visual. I found with this scene as well. Yes. It's not just, and that's what enticed me. I mean, the thing is that, you know, we came out of the 80s, moved to the 90s, and you didn't want to think about the last decade. It was, you know, any shots, you know, etc. You just kind of wanted to move on. And I think it kind of had that for maybe the next 10, 20 years. But all of a sudden, I think people have been going, and you know this more than ever so, you know, people have just been kind of like, that decade was great. It was like a golden period, and people just, they're delving back into it.
Was it though?
It really was, Nick. It was amazing. And you were such a massive part of it. I mean, the hairstyle and everything, it was all so hilarious.
It's just really interesting listening to Jess talk because it's, I mean, both you and I have had time, we're just trying to escape those kind of, you know, the mantle of being an 80s bloke, you know. And in fact, to the extent that when I recorded I didn't actually record it. The movie Eddie the Eagle or whatever, Gary Barlow was putting together the music for it, and he wanted some 80s. He wanted some new 80s sounding things, and I was really busy. I didn't have anything, but I had a song called "The Sky's the Limit" that kind of fit the thing. So I sent it to him.
That's a shit song.
Yeah, I know. That's all I had. So I sent it to him, and then he called up and said, "Yeah, it's great, but we want to make it sound a bit more 80s. Can you do that?" And I didn't know how to do that.
Wow.
I didn't have a clue how to do that because I didn't really understand what it was about the 80s that made the 80s the 80s. We were just using what the emerging technologies. Yeah, yeah. We were just doing what, you know, we were definitely kids in the candy shops, you know, because all this stuff was, nobody had heard this stuff before, all the drum machines and all the synth technologies that were coming out. And we were just sort of experimenting and just getting stuck in, weren't we? So we didn't know we were making a particular sound. We were just kind of, you know, you press that button and it makes that noise, and that's all. Oh, let's write a song around that.
To me, that is just kind of mind-blowing almost, because for me, your sound, you know, just kind of encapsulated that period, so much of it for me personally.
Right.
And, you know, there were, you know, tracks like Radio Musicola. I mean, just the production of it. I mean, when I heard that the first time, in the first two chords, you know, the opening two chords, I could just put that on loop and listen to it for hours.
Blimey, he's under the difficult third album.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know,
you're not messing about.
You know, that's fascinating.
That's the test, though.
That is the test.
Before you two both arrived, I was singing B-sides to Ricky in the kitchen, and he's going, no, don't remember writing that. No, don't remember this at all.
He actually sent me a track the other day. It was a B-side of one of Kim's tracks, and it was like hearing the song for the first time.
Wow.
Really?
I'd totally forgotten.
Yeah.
I was waiting for the chorus. What the fucking chorus like? Yeah. Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a bit weird.
Yeah, it's good when you surprise yourself like that.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
What inspired you when you first started, when you first got your deal? Because I know that you were, you played in some bands around the Ipswich area.
Yeah.
And you did covers and stuff. When you got your deal with MCA, what did you have an idea of what your sound was? Did you know?
I don't know if I knew what my sound was. I mean, I spent the previous three or four years playing in basically a function to earn a living. We were a functions band, we did everything from Cole Porter to, you know, the Birdie song. We did everything, which is a brilliant kind of apprenticeship for me, just learning guitar chords apart from anything else, the ones that I actually bothered to figure out. I gave up on Cole Porter middle eight, so I just wasn't ever there. So there were so many things going on in my head. I wasn't, and I was aware of the charts, and I had Off the Wall, and I had Stevie Wonder albums, and I was kind of connected to that part of the music world in that respect. But I didn't really know. I wasn't thinking I'm going to be a pop star or whatever. I was just kind of writing songs, demoing them on a mate's TAC Porter studio.
I had fun of those.
Yeah.
Me too.
Absolutely. Yeah. and just sort of putting them out there and seeing if anybody,
No record company tinkering then. They kind of, when they signed you,
they didn't sign me to start with. They weren't interested in the first place. There was and I've got, the usual pile of rejection slips. Then I got a manager who took the same tape to the same people.
Mickey Modern?
Yeah, Mickey. And then he ended up with a deal. And then the conversation comes, well, who's going to produce it? And then, because that's obviously going to make a huge difference to how it's going to sound. And I did some demos with Rupert Hine.
Wasn't Pete Waterman involved somehow as well?
Not as much as he says he was.
This is the stuff we want.
Unlike me.
he managed Peter Collins.
Oh, right, that's the
connection.
Oh,
he had a production company called Loose Ends.
Ah.
And Peter was in that stable, and he turned up every now and again. Right. Pete, yeah. I'm going to keep diplomat. I'm going to leave it there. But yeah, so
did MCA at the beginning when you got signed? Did they give you? Did they have an idea of what artist they wanted you to be? Or
I didn't really even know. I don't even remember that, because it was just basically it all happened very quickly, and then all of a sudden I was in Salme's studio with Peter Collins. Starting the process, and it was basically just copying the demos and just making the demos sound better, sounding like they weren't recorded on a Porter studio. But the initial stage it was like Juno 60,
right?
Me playing the bass and drum machines, and then we got Charlie Morgan in to play the drums. Then it got to a point which I, because I'm not a keyboard player, I just kind of mess about, and I like the noises they make. That's all I know. So it came to a point.
But then you listen to Human Racing,
I didn't play the keyboards.
You wrote it. Yeah.
I didn't write it, but that was my mate Reg who brought that to life, really. But
is that right then? Reg actually played the keyboards on.
Yeah, well, I was in the band I was telling you about previously. Yeah. This is a blind keyboard player called Reg Webb.
I saw an interview with him.
Who sadly is no longer with us. He left us last year. He played on the original demo, which is about 2 or 3 years old.
And it was called Look Behind You at that time, is that right?
I know, it's everything. This is amazing. It was called Look Behind You, and it had two choruses. No, I only had one chorus instead of the two, I think. And then we're struggling, man. We got all the best session players. We had some great keyboard players on that album, but none of them could really nail this particular thing. Yeah. This wasn't feeling like the demo. And, and Peter said, well, who played on the demo? And I said, well, my mate Reg. We'll say, well, get your fucking mate Reg in it. So we did, and we wheeled him in, and he just sort of,
It's
all over it.
Honestly, Nick, that song is, even to the, I was listening to it just last week. Today, it's still, it just never, that flame it has just never goes out. It's just incredible.
And still sounds as fresh as when you first hear it. It's
unbelievable.
Perfect, isn't it?
Unbelievable.
Beautiful production, beautiful vocal, Nick, I've got to say.
Shut up.
Wow. you smashed it, mate.
Funny you should mention Charlie Morgan. This is how I'm going in full nerd mode now, right?
Go for it.
Because obviously he was a session drummer, right?
Yeah.
So not too many people would have known him necessarily.
Yeah.
And I was at some music fair in Kensington Olympia or something, 80.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra.
Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
5 or whatever. And me being the nerd, I knew what he looked like. I knew, I'd done my research right to that degree. And I was like, that's Charlie. And I was with a mate who didn't know him, you know, from Adam. I was like, that's Charlie Morgan. So I had to go up to him, and he didn't know me from Adam. I'm like, hello, Charlie. You're Charlie, aren't you? He said, yeah, yeah, yeah. I said, thank you for the work you did on Nick's albums. It's amazing. And he was actually really nice to me, actually. He was like, oh, thanks, you know. Because, you know, I think he was quite surprised that someone, you know, came up to him and, you know, for that work. But, he's just an incredible drummer.
Wow.
But I have another, maybe later on, another key Charlie Morgan stroke Mark King question you, but
one of those,
yeah.
Go for it now. Really? Yeah.
Well, God, I'm going in a supernova nerd. I mean, I was a major Level 42 fan,
yeah,
like your good self, and you know, I used to be practicing all the lines with my mate Omar. And we had this music shop down in Canterbury, and we used to go down there after school and get the bases off and just stick the compressor on and
slap away.
Yeah, slap away, you know. And because obviously my sort of story with you is I'd heard I Won't Let the Sun Go Down, Wouldn't It Be Good, you know, they were floating around in the charts. I was still at school and we'd gone on a school holiday somewhere, and there was a friend of mine, she had the album on cassette, and she just kept playing it. And you know, a lot of albums, there's the standout singles, but what took me by surprise was the quality of every track on that album. It was just like one after the, and I kept, well, that's good too, you know, drum talking. But you know, it just, and at that point I was just, you know, hook, line and sinker, you know. And then kind of followed all the way that through, and I knew the riddle was coming. I think Don Quixote was the first single, is that right?
I think the riddle was the first single.
Was it the riddle?
Yeah.
And then obviously the 12-inch was in the shops, and I'd gone down there and got my savings. And then I listened to Easy, and I thought, that's Mark King. At that point, head blown.
Yeah.
It's like Nick Kershaw and Mark King. Oh, my God. I mean, literally, I could not believe it. It was like Christmas in what I think it was November or whatever that album came out. And so I was, I was imagining, God, to be a fly on the wall when you recorded that with him. And I was always curious, how did that come about? Did you know him before then, or was it a manager connection? And when you did you have that song kind of partially written, or was it a jam session? Did you record the whole thing? Is there more material?
There's like 12 questions.
If you sorry, shut up a minute, I'll tell you.
I told you I'm going supernova nerd here.
Right.
You
so
can answer now.
Can I just say, I'm now getting a little bit of insight into what it's like for you when I talk to you, but carry on.
I'm sorry, Nick.
This is
just question number
wonders,
one of
wonders
22.
For my ego.
Yeah. I'm going to get my pad out in a minute.
So, I was doing Top of the Pops, one of the singles of the first album. I can't remember what it was. I'm just sitting there during rehearsals, and I get a tap on the shoulder. It's Mark.
Whoa.
And I didn't know him, although I used to go and watch Level 42 right in South, and when I were doing clubs right in South End and stuff like
yeah
that, and I was a big fan of Level 42. So he introduced himself and said, blah, 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 blah. and Kenny Johnson will play on your next album.
You are kidding.
No.
And you went, I'm not too sure.
I haven't really caught anything ready.
If you get a bit better.
So, about 2 months later, we started recording the second album. And I mentioned this to my producer, Pete Collins, and he went, who's Mark King?
What?
So, right. Okay.
That's a new reality. Well,
he does this. So I went and I wrote that for him.
I thought, well, I've got to have something
because there's nothing that because I've done most of the bass already on the album, and there wasn't really anything there that I thought would do him justice, so I thought, oh, I'll write one for him.
So that whole, you know, was that your line that he then... Good grief. You are a superb, super, super talent. Wow.
I do remember that night, though. That was a great night. That was one of those, you know, you've got the memories of just little studio moments and stuff, and that one, I'll never lose that one. That was a great night.
So you literally were in the studio, all set up to go, and then just rehearsed the song, or did you jam, or...?
No, I'd sent him a cassette. I think I'd sent him a cassette. I'm not even sure I had.
Wow.
I'm beginning to think now that he just turned up, and we played...
Right, there and then.
A demo to him, and there wasn't much of a demo, I don't think. I just had the sort of basic chords, and it goes like this. And it's just me, Charlie, and Mark. And then we did it, and it was quite quick, and we did a couple of takes. And it was way past Peter Collins' bedtime, because he goes, I'm at 8, you know, 7:59, it's right, I'm going to bed. So this was like sort of 10 up past 10, 11 o'clock at night, so he was way past his bedtime, but he was sitting there with his gob open. He couldn't believe what he'd just seen. And then so we did it, and then we came back into the studio, and we thought, oh, that's brilliant, wow, thanks Mark. And he said, do you want me to track it? I said, I beg your pardon? Do you want me to track it? Okay. So he tracked everything he just played, note for note.
Amazing.
Good grief.
I think it might have taken him two takes. But he
Wow.
It's unbelievable.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a good night.
Amazing. Amazing track.
But there was nearly... I nearly actually started a band with him. There were with
what?
Me, him and Mark, and me, him and Simon Phillips.
Oh, my God. That would have been incredible.
Because I knew Simon from... He just lived down the road from me.
Really?
Yeah.
In Ipswich?
Well, I didn't live in Ipswich then.
Oh, that's right, in London.
Yeah, he lived in a little village in Essex called Bures.
Wow.
He said, let's do it. We had a few rehearsals and stuff, but it never sort of came to anything.
And did you record any of that by any chance?
No, there might have been a sort of a dodgy old tape of a rehearsal at some point.
But wow.
I'm saying it probably doesn't exist anymore, but I'd be amazed. You're amazed at some things that just turn up on YouTube.
Yeah,
I mean, some of my old demos.
Likewise,
unbelievable.
Yeah.
And
where
some,
did they find them?
I don't know. And some, I mean, things I've never heard of. There was somewhere on there's a tape of me playing an acoustic version of "I Won't Let the Sun Go Down on Me" with commentary. Just me explaining to the keyboard player what I wanted him to play in the studio and stuff.
Wow.
No specific keyboard player, but just in my head going, what? Then there's a line here that does that and there's that.
Wow.
And that, where did that, I didn't even know it existed.
Oh, I think I've even heard that. Where are you explaining the chord changes on the guitar?
Yeah, probably, something like that.
Because I listened to it and I thought...
Because I didn't even know what it was. Yeah. Someone sent it to me and I thought, what is this? That is me. That is me. And I can even envisage the room I would have been sitting in a dodgy old rented farmer's cottage in Essex.
Wow.
Yeah.
Another final nerd question on the Easy Mark King thing. The chords that you put together there. One of the things I think I really admire about your music, and I think this may come from the fusion you know, sort of pre-Nick Kershaw era, yeah. is that you managed to... I was quite into jazz funk and things like that, and there were lots of progressions and epic things that were pretty much just for that niche crowd. You couldn't take them much further, you know. People yeah. be like, what you playing, you know. But you managed to somehow transcribe those into much more wider commercial music, you know, on a know-how. You know, when it all breaks down, bam, bam. I mean, that's almost like a jazz funk, you know, people are just going to go right into the solos and do everything there. Yeah. Similarly, Cloak and Dagger, that guitar line, there's loads of space and then yeah. the chords come in and everything else. And I think...
it's really intricate stuff, isn't it?
It
but,
is.
But the melodies and the hooks...
are very clean.
Yeah, just so hooky. It's quite unusual to hear that those two together,
yeah,
hand in hand,
yeah, exactly, yeah. And it made it so accessible at the same time. And on Easy, you know, you've got that great line, and then those that whole chord sequence there. Do you remember by any chance what you played that on? What synth that was? That's real super nerd, isn't it? That is.
I don't know if I played any keyboards on that.
Really?
No, I just played guitar on it.
Who played the keyboards?
A lot of it would have been Andy Richards.
Oh, okay.
I think, yes, I think I'm pretty sure it was Andy Richards, and also in that line at the when it was just those chords underneath there, I can't really claim credit for that for those. I think there's something that happened in the studio.
I mean, whatever that is.
I mean, that's all that Joe's on and all and whatever going right. on there. That's,
but you let it happen.
I let it happen.
I was
in the room when it happened.
Did you know when you recorded your album, the debut album? Did you know you had a hit? Did you know? Did you think certain songs would do better than they do, or vice versa? Were you surprised that certain ones did better?
I don't know if you think the same thing, Rick. But when it all kicks off, when it all starts, and you're having all this attention lavished on you, you've got record companies spending a fortune, you're in this amazing studio, you know, you're with the top session players, and everything's kind of, wow, this is... I'm surrounded by people that are telling you you're great and it's going to happen. But you've got absolutely no doubt it's going to happen. I'm going to be huge. It's absolutely no.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of energy which is really useful yeah. to harness when you and it's... because it gives you more creative energy, and it just kind of, it's a real driving force
yeah.
behind making it happen. And it happened. And then you think, well, of course it did.
Why?
Yeah, right. It
yeah. Why wouldn't it?
But then afterwards you look around you and you go, actually, that was just fucking lucky, wasn't it? Because and you bump into all these incredibly talented people who had the same, you know, they had the same thing happen to them and it didn't happen.
Yeah. Right. Mm.
You know, because right.
it's a planet. I always say this: it's planets aligning. You need yeah, every single totally. Part it's to work.
It's the right TV show coming yeah. at the right yeah. time. Yeah. It's a disc jockey that yeah. wants to play it, and
yeah.
and
the right record label. The right A&R guy.
Absolutely.
The right decision on the first single of the album. Or
yeah,
because if you get that wrong, then it might fall over.
You got given another go at it back then. So I think
yeah,
I
true.
Won't
yeah,
Let the Sun Go Down was the first single. Yes. Didn't go top 40.
Yeah.
But you were allowed to keep going. Some bands now, that first single, it's a one single deal. Yeah. That yeah. doesn't work.
Yeah, you're gone.
Goodbye. Absolutely.
We had a similar yeah. thing, because we had a manager at the time, very early 90s, and he managed to get us to EMI, and he'd taken some stuff in, and he came back to me and was on the phone. Yeah, Jess, you know, I've got an A&R guy at EMI interested, and they're willing to pay for some more demos. You know, ah, boy, this is amazing, you know. And we went in, recorded this track, great big epic kind of thing, and it all sounded great. And we thought, that's got some potential legs or whatever. Sent it back, change of A&R guy. His comment is, yeah, come back when you've got a hit single.
Yeah, yeah. I think we've all heard that one before,
yeah,
haven't we?
Yeah,
it's horrible.
Definitely heard that one.
The worst phrase you ever want to hear.
I know, but it was kind of it was an interesting, because I had this foolish idea that, you know, you're just going to get signed and everything's going to be taken care of, and it really, you know, just too young really, and not able to sort of compute everything that's necessary.
And automatically that phrase puts pressure on you as a writer. It's not like go in and make a great record or a great song.
What happened to development?
Make a hit record. Make a song that not only you like, but everybody else has got to like as well. Fucking hell.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard enough. It's hard enough to write a song anyway, but let alone with those constrictions.
That's a very good point.
And I don't know about you, but I only started thinking about what it was to write a hit song when people stop buying them. Is that right?
Because you start analysing it, it's all
think,
over.
Well, you know, well, I make music and people buy it. It's as simple as that. Yeah. You know, and then all of a sudden people aren't buying it so much and they're buying other stuff and you're going, what am I doing wrong? And then you start analysing and you think, what was it about that record that made, or that song that made it hit? And it probably, and it, like we just said, it wasn't just the song. It was a whole bunch of collective factors, things that got lumped together. That's the reason it was a hit. You know, so you can't just say, it's the song. It's totally the song. It never is. It's always other stuff going on.
Well, talking of writing, and I've heard you mention this a couple of times, between Human Racing and The Riddle, you were given 2 weeks to write the material for The Riddle.
Pretty much.
Really? It was really 2 weeks? Oh, my God. And did you have any material at that time?
I had Wide Boy.
Right.
That was, in fact, that nearly made it onto the first album. That was quite an old song.
Right.
That's it. That's all I have.
And you literally, everything, you did sort of complete that mission, as it were.
Pretty much, yeah, apart from Easy.
Wow.
Because it already started recording.
I mean, given 2 weeks, that is a seriously impressive fortnight's work, Nick.
I know.
Back in 82, 81, 82, when Kids was suddenly took off.
Right.
And Mickey Moe said, right, you better go and do the album. And it's kind of like, the whole pressure of that whole thing. Yeah. I look back on that now.
Yeah.
How did I do that?
No, same. Why did I do that? You know, why did I agree to have another album released within 9 months of the first one?
Yeah.
And I was still promoting the Human Racing at the time.
I mean, harder for you, Nick. I mean, as an artist as well, as writer, for me, obviously Kim was going out there and doing all the promotion for it and the photo sessions and the interviews and blah, blah, blah. Whereas for me, I was just stuck in the studio so at least I had the time to be able to
Why didn't anyone want to take your photo? Really?
They did, but I wouldn't let them. At least I had a little bit of time to be able to do that. But you can't write on tour. You can't write.
I was wondering, because you know it is such an amazing body of work. You know, and that's why I was thinking. Surely, maybe between a gig, you know, you just hear that, or there's a little idea on the tour bus or whatever. Wow,
Do you remember that? It must be so intense.
I don't remember it being that intense. That's the weird thing. We were living, because even though the first album had done so well, the money hadn't come through yet. So we were still living in a little one up, one down terraced house just in Sibyl Hurlingham in Essex.
I know it well.
It wasn't a one up, because I had a spare bedroom, and then the spare bedroom was where, you know, was where the Juno 60.
Oh, lavish then.
And a TR-808.
Oh, yeah.
A bunch of, you know, just and a Revox or something, just some kind of means of recording stuff was up there. And I just remember spending 2 weeks in that bedroom, and I didn't have. By the time, because the producer came over as well, sort of towards the end of that period.
Yeah.
And he was kind of...
To see what you've been doing.
To see what I've been up to for the last 2 weeks. And he went, But I got... literally, come back when you've got a single.
No way.
No, pretty much, because he said, well, I can't hear a single.
Oh, no way.
But I hadn't written the riddle.
Oh, my God.
I hadn't written the riddle.
Oh, I see.
So that was literally the last thing I did in that two-week period was the riddle.
Wow. And can I ask you, when you had one of my favourite tracks from that album is Wild Horses.
Okay.
And whenever that goes on, at any point, it still has the same emotional impact for me. It's unusual, you know, some songs you just kind of, you've crossed that path and you've heard it before, but Wild Horses just still gets me every single time. My dad, my old man, is a very big fan, and it's really bizarre that almost a week before we knew this was going to happen, we talk on the phone and literally we talk about your tracks and things like this. And we'd mentioned it, and my dad was like, yeah, who was that guy in Wild Horses? Who was the guy, you know?
Asking me what my lyrics were about from 35 years ago is like a real struggle for me, because I'm kind of, what was I thinking?
It's such a weird thing as a fan. That is such a weird thing. Like we were talking about earlier when I asked Ricky about songs, and he's like, I have absolutely no idea. They've taken on such a new life.
Well, and they change. The meaning changes as well.
Yeah.
I remember after writing the song, I wouldn't have a clue, and then you do interviews, and after a while, after sort of 200 interviews about the same thing, and being asked the same questions about the same songs, you start getting an idea about what the song's about, and you start thinking, oh, actually, yeah, it's about, oh, it could be about this,
I love the story about the riddle.
Yeah,
where you had the radio station saying that there's competition.
Yeah, Bruno Brooks.
Bruno Brooks. Tell that story, I love it.
Well, basically, this is no massive secret anymore. The riddle is basically a load of bollocks. From start to finish, it was a guide vocal. I wrote the lyric.
A guide lyric.
I wrote it really quickly because we're going into the studio the next week, and I mean, I needed something to record as a guide vocal, and it never got rewritten because we got so used to the sound of the words and everything.
Yeah.
And just everything I tried afterwards, it doesn't sound right. We're just so used to this. So yeah, and we called it the riddles, and that people think it's about something. That's a really good idea. And then not only did MCA, the marketing people at MCA, start a competition to find out what
I didn't know
without
this.
Telling me.
Without telling me.
Why? But then I walk into Radio 1 on a live interview, and Bruno Brooks says, and the Nick will be telling us what the riddle's about at the end of the program.
No, he won't. He really won't. Oh, that is too funny.
Nick doesn't have a fucking clue.
When we met Grace Lightman last week, as we were talking about, and we talk about some of her lyrics are a bit off the wall.
They're
a bit unusual, and we were asking what her process was, and she talked about they got this sort of great sound happening but couldn't quite get the lyrics to it. So they wrote the alphabet out on bits of paper and chopped them up and just wrote words for each letter and put them on the floor, picked them up randomly, and she just sang the words that were on the paper.
It's a bit Bowie-esque.
The lines that we were talking about for her song was, I think that tennis is super cool, it feels so one-dimensional, lemonade, bring it to the hotel. And that's
right.
But in the song, it sounds absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
But you read it back and you hear it, you're like, what is that about? And she's like,
when Lee says it like that, it does sound pretty weird.
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But you hear it on the tune.
It kind of makes sense. It all makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's just another instrument, isn't it? The voice.
Yeah.
It's the words in one sense. They're for, okay, you can write a song about something and connect with somebody through the words. That's easy. But another thing about the singing is a voice, and basically words are just a vehicle for vowel sounds and consonants and just kind of the sound of something. That's all they are.
My favorite lyric of yours, funnily enough, is Pocket Full of Fluff from Easy.
Is it?
Yeah,
I don't even know there's a pocket full of fluff.
Yeah.
Is there a pocket full of fluff in Easy?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, I got a pocket full of fluff.
Oh wow!
Yeah, but it's absolutely brilliant.
Have you been singing something else?
Lee says this to me, and I just think,
and he looks at me. I see him glaze over, and he's like,
"No." I just wondered if you were kind of going through the lyric process. You know, we've all been there, and there's just the one line that you cannot come up with.
Yeah.
So you've got something down, and it just stuck. But what I thought was genius about that, and I think what's genius about some of your lyrics is they are just throwaway everyday phrases that everyone has used
hooky.
Or hears.
Hooky. Really hooky.
And yeah, you managed to turn it into, God, yeah, that's what it's just, and I think that's why your music connects so well, or lyric connects.
That's so true, you know, there's certain phrases that you use in your writing, Nick, that I've not analysed. When I'm writing, I always think, what people say here, and then you...
Well, that's what people say. Right. I mean, if it's a phrase, if it's already familiar to people, you're kind of halfway
but,
there, aren't you?
Yeah. The fascinating thing is, you would think, a pocket full of fluff, you feel like that's just like a crazy little line, but the thing is just about everyone has gone,
that's so true.
I feel that's so true. It feels like it could be the title for your new album.
I'm actually struggling to find a title.
Yeah, what a beautiful chat that was. You can tell there's a lovely energy in the room. It was so lovely for Jess to meet Nick and for us to meet Jess as well. I know Nick and I were thrilled to meet him. He's a lovely guy, incredible talent. His new album is just absolutely beautiful. Please download it or buy it, even better. It's called Cherry Crush, and beautiful tracks like Lipstick and Sushi, especially that one, I absolutely adore. So yeah, check it out. Please tune in next week for part two of this beautiful conversation. And I'll look forward to seeing you then. Have a great week. Bye. You have been listening to Unsung Heroes with me, Ricky Wilde, Jake Wood and Lee Bennett. Produced and created by myself and Jake Wood for Wildwood Productions. With music and editing, again by myself, Ricky Wilde. Artwork by Scarlett Wilde and hosted by Acast. Just to remind you that there is a link in the notes directing you to a Spotify playlist featuring all the songs we have discussed in this episode. Many thanks for listening. Unsung Heroes.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.